It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is home to about 6,000 dairy farms, more than any other state. Nearly 1.3 million cows and counting. And those figures from our state agriculture department, we take a deep dive into what rural means and how the land is changing. And you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Stephen Kahn is a history professor at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. New book is called The Lies of the Land, Seeing Rural America for What It Is and Isn't. Steve, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate. This is a thrill.
Good. You write about how Americans often talk about rural life using both the language of crisis and the language of myth. And you take particular issue with the word crisis. Why is that?
Yeah. Well, I think over the last, I don't know what it's been now, 5-8 years, this is the word, if you look in the newspapers, that comes up repeatedly when we talk about what's going on in rural places. And I'm a historian, so I need to go back. And what I discovered is that, in fact, people have been talking about rural America in crisis every decade since probably the 1870s and maybe even before that. I didn't go all the way back. And so if you could sort of look at every decade and somebody is talking about how rural America is in crisis, I sort of was starting to scratch my head and think, well, when was rural America therefore not in crisis? And therefore maybe that's not the right way for us to be talking about this in the first place.
Why are you challenging these long-held views of rural America?
Well, I think it starts. I'm gonna get a little autobiographical here. I'm a big city kid. I grew up in Philadelphia. I lived on the East Coast, and then I moved to Ohio, and now I live in a very small town, surrounded by corn and soybean fields, and I teach in a slightly larger town. Also surrounded by soybean and corn fields. And so I guess with these two perspectives, I just didn't think that the conversation we were having about rural America was getting us anywhere. I didn't think it was very useful. And so I thought, well, is there a different way? Can I bring a different set of lenses to look at all of this? Because what I was reading, what I was finding, just as I said, seemed to go round and round. It's about a crisis. It's about a crisis. It's about a crisis. And I just am not sure that's gotten us anywhere. So I thought I'd look into it myself.
You bring up about some outside perspective. A friend of yours from China told you that Chinese people who come to the U.S. call our rural areas the big empty. And you say that that phrase stuck with you. What significance does the big empty have?
Yeah, I love that phrase. And I really, my colleague who gave it to me, I owe her a debt. I think one of the things that I was really struck by the first time I ever went to visit China, which was about 25 years ago, was going in between these Chinese cities, these big Chinese cities, through the Chinese countryside and realizing just how busy it all was. Whereas in this country, we associate being out in the country with being really not, that you don't see anybody. There's nobody out there. It's all kind of empty. And I think that that's part of the mythology, or that sort of underscores the mythology that we have about rural places, that they are empty, that they are somehow tranquil and they don't change a lot. And that's what we want to see when we go out there. It's not really true that they may be empty of people, but that doesn't mean they aren't empty in all kinds of other ways.
You know, I introduce you by counting the number of farms we have here in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And I wonder, does that ignore other kinds of rural places? Because I feel like, at least I do, have the, when I think of rural, I think of farms.
Yep. So this might not be the best way to start off a book, but I think the very first sentence in my book is, a book about rural America is a ridiculous idea. Because as you're driving at here, there are all different kinds of rural places. Rural places are farms. Yes, that's kind of what we think of, but they're also mining areas and timber areas, which was, you know, folks who live up in the northern parts of Wisconsin are certainly aware of all of that. They constitute desperately poor areas of the country. It's where a majority of Indian reservations are found, right? They constitute some of the richest counties in the country, like Teton, Wyoming, which claims to be the wealthiest county per capita in the United States. So, right, rural America is a vastly diverse place, but I do think that when we talk about it, when we use the language, we're projecting an image of family farm. And that's sort of part of what I also wanted to deconstruct a little bit here, was to get us to see these places in a much more multiplicitous sort of way.
Reexamining depictions of rural America, Steve Kahn, our guide, history professor, author of the new book, The Lies of the Land. You can join in along the way. Your questions and comments are welcome. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Steve, you say, you know, widespread views of rural life are often romanticized and depicted as ideal and healthy and simpler. Where do the romanticized views come from?
Well, they come all the way back. They go all the way back to the 18th century. And I'm sure many readers, many of your listeners will recognize the phrase of Thomas Jefferson's when he talked about the United States as a nation of yeoman farmers. Mm-hmm. Was Jefferson himself a yeoman farmer? Absolutely not. But he had a projection of what ought to be, that we should be a nation of land-owning, self-sufficient, agrarian people. And it's not clear that that was ever the case, but that fantasy, that, as I said, that mythology persisted. You find it persisted. You see it in writings across the 19th century. In the 20th century, it gets reinforced in radio shows and television shows and articles in the Saturday Evening Post and things like this. It's really, for I think a lot of urban and metropolitan Americans, rural America is a blank slate, and it's onto which we can simply project what we wish rural America was really like.
You know, the view being that rural America is nearly entirely white, who is left out of this rural America when you look at the people living in sparsely populated areas?
Sure. That's a great point. Rural America, again, depending on where you are in the country, has always been home to African Americans, to Native people, to people of Hispanic origins one way and another. And that's also still the case. One of the ways in which this rural white mythology is perpetuated in the popular culture is through country music. And one of the things I think you don't hear much when you listen to country music are songs about Central American slaughterhouse workers in Iowa. But those rural slaughterhouses in Iowa are staffed by people who are all speaking Spanish, and they tend, therefore, those sorts of people tend to get ignored as we project this image of kind of little house on the prairie onto rural America.
Miami University of Ohio history professor Steve Kahn's new book, it's called The Lies of the Land, Putting Rural America into Sharper Focus, What It Means. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is known as America's dairyland, over 64,000 farms and roughly 14 million acres. That's from the State Agriculture Department. We explore attributes of rural Wisconsin and America and how this land is changing. You can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Steve Kahn is a history professor at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. Book is called The Lies of the Land. Steve, we're going to turn to the Army Corps of Engineers, and one of your chapters really looks at the role of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in militarizing rural America. And then in 1970, we learn Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson talked about the division was akin to a beaver because of the agency's, you know, rampant construction of dams. What has the role been of the Army Corps in rural parts of America?
That was a great line from Senator Nelson. I was really pleased to have found that when I was doing my research. So let's imagine a map of the lower 48 states, and I think there isn't a single watershed in the entire continental United States that hasn't been shaped, altered, affected in one way or another by the Army Corps of Engineers. The Army Corps of Engineers goes all the way back to 1774. It's actually the reason West Point was created very early in the 19th century, to produce engineers. And what they have done is to transform the landscape of the nation through the management of water and watersheds, one, as I said, one way and another. In the 19th century, canals. In the 20th century, dams. And so when we think about the way in which rural America is shaped by the federal government, which I think is a really key piece of understanding how rural America operates, the Army Corps of Engineers is kind of Exhibit A. This means irrigation projects. It means flood control projects so that people can live in certain areas which they otherwise might not be able to live in. It's a vast operation. It is more or less unaccountable, the Army Corps of Engineers, I discovered. And its influence has just been profound.
What has its influence been on Native Americans?
Well, I think one of the things that, and I'm going to simplify here, but in the 19th century, the U.S. Army cleared indigenous people out of the country and created a reservation system. Between 1790 and about 1890, there were more than 1,600 military encounters between the U.S. Army and indigenous people of one degree or another. When the Army Corps turns to then reshaping these spaces, Native Americans have often found themselves either flooded out, and I tell the story of the Kinzua Dam Project, which was in sort of on the border between New York and Pennsylvania, in which the Seneca Nation found itself flooded out by a dam project that was built in the 1960s, or they find themselves alternately with water diverted from where they're now residing because the Army Corps has moved the water in a different direction. So Native Americans continued to be shaped adversely by the Army and the Army Corps of Engineers, even though the military conflicts were officially over.
Turning to military installations, you cite Camp Hood, Texas, as an example of a military installation transforming a rural area. What happens to rural communities when they're made into military towns?
Yeah, two things. Or let's say it goes in two directions. In a place like Fort Hood in Texas, this was a kind of scrubby part of Texas as late as the 1930s. World War II breaks out. The Army decides it needs a big Army base there. So the first thing that happens are all the ranchers and farmers are cleared off the land, eminent domain. And then the land is used for training. It's used for ordnance testing. It's at Fort Hood in particular. They like to roll tanks. So the landscape itself and the environment itself is totally chewed up. But it's an enormous base now with staff and soldiers who are rotating in and out. So let's say the ecology of local businesses changes entirely. Now it's pizza shops and used car dealerships and strip joints, which have replaced whatever used to be there before the Army showed up. The other thing that happens, and I tell the story somewhat closer to Wisconsin of an Air Force base on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, when the Army comes in, or in this case it was the Air Force, when the military comes in, it transforms, as I've just said. But in that case, the base closed in the mid-1990s, and that was like an economic implosion for Marquette County, Michigan, from which it really still hasn't recovered. So when rural communities become dependent on that kind of military spending, when the spending goes away, they're left with real economic problems.
You called K.I. Sawyer Air Base the nickname Little Detroit. Can you explain how rural blight occurred in the UP after Sawyer closed?
Sure. Well, when Sawyer closed, and it was a function, there were lots of base closings that were happening at the end of the Cold War. Sawyer was one of those. So all the staff and personnel leave. All of the businesses that service that base leave. Schools begin to close. They can't make their budgets because there are no more kids and there's no more tax revenue. And what this left, therefore, by the end of the 1990s was abandonment and people who were still living there, but living below the poverty line because they didn't really have any options for getting out. So people started to refer to the area around Sawyer as Little Detroit because of the abandonment that was just visible. These small houses that used to have Air Force personnel or whatnot were all just now empty. And it's, I think you see that in a number of places where the military came and then the military left.
We dig into depictions of rural America. Steve Kahn is here, history professor, author of the new book, The Lies of the Land. You can join in with your questions, your perspectives, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Ruth in Ladysmith. Ruth, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering why all the subsidies are going to these corporates, government-funded farms, and not to the hands of the backbreaking family farms. So many family farms have had to close because they do not get the same milk price per 100 pounds of milk that they produce that the big corporate government-funded farms get.
Ruth, thank you. A little bit difficult to hear, Steve, but wanting to have you contrast the subsidies of corporate-funded farms versus what is happening on smaller family farms here in Wisconsin and elsewhere.
So thank you for that question, Ruth. I think there are two answers to it. The most immediate answer is that the agriculture department, starting in the 1950s under President Eisenhower, but then really accelerating in the 1970s under the agriculture department of President Nixon, absolutely wanted to go to for agriculture to become big and increasingly industrial scale. Some listeners may remember the agriculture secretary under Nixon was a guy named Earl Butz. And his favorite phrase when he would give speeches was, get big or go out of business. So he had no use for small-scale, family-style farms. And so ag policy under the Nixon administration was all designed to make agriculture bigger and bigger and bigger, and therefore squeezing out smaller and smaller producers. The second answer to the question is that, in fact, the forces that affect agriculture, sort of making it, squeezing family farms, have been at work for a long time. International Harvester, which again, many listeners are very familiar with, launched an ad campaign in the 1920s where they said, every farm a factory. So the idea that what we really wanted to do was to make agricultural production just as large scale, just as efficient, if that's the right word, as Ford motor cars or what have you, has been going on for over 100 years in this country. And small scale, especially diversified farms, a farm that would grow corn and do dairy, they got squeezed out. And that squeeze, people started talking about that as early as the 1940s and 50s.
And so that's where you hear like the rise of agribusiness and
sure.
mass-produced crops where, you know.
That's right.
Yeah.
These kind of monoculture situations are relatively new. And certainly, in you know, like in the history of agriculture, they're absolutely new, that you would just have 2,000 acres of a single crop. That's really new. But it is all about federal policy that begins under Eisenhower and, as I said, accelerates under Richard Nixon.
Historian Steve Kahn, challenging the notion of a rural America in crisis, new book called The Lies of the Land. And you can join the discussion about rural places. Ask a question, share your perspectives at any point. Call in at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hundreds of thousands of jobs are connected to agriculture in Wisconsin, according to state figures. We learn about big forces shaping rural areas, effects on Wisconsin's landscape. Steve Kahn is a professor of history at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. New book is called The Lies of the Land. Call in with a question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Steve, we heard from Rich in Rhinelander, who says that rural areas are often masked by the larger metro areas nearby. Like, people think of Chicago when thinking of Illinois, or they think of New York City, and rather than focus on the entire population of the state of New York. What then happens to that perception when we're totally focused on those huge metro areas?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because I think the traffic goes both ways. I think that while, and I know this from doing my research, that there is a feeling on the part of a lot of folks that all of the attention goes to New York City or Chicago. Politically, it is still the case that rural voters are overrepresented, both at the state level in almost every state, and then, of course, at the national level through the Electoral College and the Senate and so on and so forth. So on the one hand, yeah, it may be that our sitcoms are now largely set in New York City, but in our politics, rural areas are overrepresented. It's true in Pennsylvania. It's true in Illinois. It's true in lots and lots of states. As I said, in addition to our national politics as well.
Mary Lisa from Shawano wants to go deeper on that, and saying that, you know, they live in a rural area that is very red. Mary Lisa wants to know why farmers and people in rural areas often vote Republican, and asks how this loyalty to the Republican Party is affecting rural areas.
Yeah, wow. If I had an answer to that question, because I do think it's in some ways the $60,000 question for politics. So I think that there are a couple of things at play, at least that I have seen. I think since the 1980s, especially with the Reagan Revolution, the suspicion of the mistrust of the federal government has really resonated for rural voters. And I think that was a kind of deliberate strategy on the part of the Republican Party to pit rural people against the government. The irony here, of course, is that the federal government has been essential to what we mean by the development of rural America from the very, very beginning. So let me give you one example. Or let's a comparison here. In the 1930s, when the Great Depression begins and Franklin Roosevelt takes office, fewer than 10% of rural households had electricity. By 1960, over 90% of rural households had electricity, and that's all due to the New Deal's rural electrification programs. Okay, fast forward, and what you hear nowadays is that rural America has been cut off from access to high-speed internet. and then everything that descends from that, you know, information, but also its relationship to jobs and whatnot. Well, there have been efforts to try to get the federal government to initiate a kind of rural internet program that would bring high-speed internet to rural areas. That has staunchly been resisted by Republicans over the last decade or so. So when rural voters vote for Republican representatives who then turn around and don't want to do the things, say, that we did in the New Deal, there is a kind of irony here. And I do think rural people have suffered as a consequence.
When you examine federal subsidies, New Deal, the broadband infrastructure of the now, I want to also turn to the Farm Bill. Legislation originally passed in 1973 now contains ag subsidies, money for food stamps, disaster relief. How important is the Farm Bill for American farmers and for rural parts of America?
Well, so let me start by saying that, you know, when I talked about Earl Butz and the Nixon administration, that first farm bill you just referenced, 1973, kind of enshrined many of the things that that your caller Ruth was upset about. So in some ways, 50 years after the fact, we're still dealing with the, let's call it the architecture of ag policy that got set in 1973. I guess I would start answering your question, Kate, by saying the Farm Bill affects every single one of us, because what it really does is create the framework for what our food systems are going to be. And I think lots of authors have explored the way in which our food system, if we think of it as a whole, is pretty profoundly broken. But I think what has happened since 1973 is that the Farm Bill, especially the ag part of the Farm Bill, is really dominated by corporate interests, whether that's, companies like Monsanto. Well, I guess Monsanto doesn't exist anymore, but it's been swallowed up by something else. But big ag producers, the seed companies and the fertilizer companies that are associated with all of this. And it has a profound impact most immediately on producers, but it has also pretty significant consequences for those of us who have to eat each day.
Is it viewed in smaller towns as a government subsidy, or how is it viewed?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, and I'm not a journalist, I like to prefer people who are way in the past, and I can get a handle on that. But my suspicion is that, and just from the little bit that I've seen, there are lots of recipients of ag subsidies who do not see this as some kind of a subsidy. They see it as necessary, or that they deserve it, or that it's a vital national interest, and therefore it's not really a subsidy, like people on welfare, let's say, which is the kind of nasty comparison that often gets made. So they, and this, I think, has often been true in rural places. One of the interesting little studies I found, and it was from the 1960s, I think, North Dakota had the highest percentage of residents on some kind of New Deal relief program during the 1930s. By the 1950s and 60s, nobody would acknowledge that in North Dakota. It was as if this collective amnesia about the New Deal had simply descended like a fog over the state. And I thought that was really interesting as a reflection of how people think about their relationship to these federal subsidies.
Steve Kahn with us, history professor, Miami University of Ohio, author of the new book, The Lies of the Land, as we look at depictions of rural America, how it's shaped. You can join in the conversation. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Steve, you say three factors have contributed to manufacturers moving into the South and the Midwest, land, labor, lifestyle. Can you elaborate on what drew them away from urban areas?
So one of the things I think we have to recognize is that the countryside, which we think of as pastoral and so forth and full of farms, is really the site of American manufacturing now. And that was a process moving factories out of big cities into rural places that sort of started in the 30s. It accelerated during the Second World War, and then it really picked up pace in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So there are a couple of things that these factories are looking for. They're looking for cheap land because then they can build much larger manufacturing plants, usually all on one floor. They're looking for non-unionized labor. When an auto maker moves out of Detroit to build, let's say, in rural Tennessee, they're hoping that the UAW isn't going to come after them. And then they sell the idea that somehow a factory out in the country is going to be, well, it's not going to be dirty, it's not going to be messy or noisy. It's going to take on all of those mythic rural attributes that that we believe rural America ought to have. And so this, you know, again, in the 50s and 60s, as this was all being promoted, this is the kind of language that I kept hearing in my sources.
You also do a little case study on Honda and its decision to locate its engine plant in a rural area, specifically Ohio. What have you seen out of companies like Honda who are, you know, building plants in these spaces?
Yeah, so Honda builds its first manufacturing plant in what was then a small town called Marysville, Ohio. And it's exactly an example of what I was just discussing. It does not want unionized labor at all. And it's the company leaders are very explicit about this. And state officials in Ohio, this is in the late 70s, are also very explicit that, you know, if you get your workers from the countryside, they're not going to give you any trouble. They're not going to unionize. They're not going to even try to unionize. And this is very attractive to Honda. Then what Honda does after it opens its Marysville plant is to create like a whole constellation of supplier plants, mm-hmm. also in really tiny towns, so that in fact you can drive through rural Ohio and come across these satellites that are connected to the big assembly plant in Marysville. So the engines are all made in a town called Anna, Ohio, in the western part of the state. It's a town that has 1,300 people in it. More people work at that plant each day than actually live in that town. And I think that's become more and more common across a lot of rural America, especially as the auto industry left the upper Midwest, Detroit, Cleveland, even parts of Wisconsin, and followed I-75 and I-65 south into places like Tennessee and Alabama.
Here in Wisconsin, we've had this multi-year saga with electronics giant Foxconn, has left Mount Pleasant 12,000 jobs shy of what was promised by the manufacturer. What could help communities avoid this dependence on single large employers?
So, yeah, it becomes a really interesting dance. Rural communities want to compete to get these kinds of plants in their town. They throw all kinds of goodies at these companies. But of course, other communities are doing the same thing in this competition. And therefore, it becomes a kind of race to the bottom. How many years of property tax rebates are we going to give you? How much free water are we going to provide from our municipal water system? I think that those strategies of economic development work less often than people believe that they do. And I think I'm not an economic development specialist by any means, but I think sort of chasing that big white whale of a big manufacturing plant carries at least as many risks and potential pitfalls as it does success.
Miami University of Ohio history professor Steve Kahn's new book, it's called The Lies of the Land, challenging us to rethink what rural means. And there's room to talk. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts along the way. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dig into what rural means and the history of these sparsely populated areas in Wisconsin and across the nation. Historian Steve Kahn's book is called The Lies of the Land. Call in with a question. You can share what's on your mind. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Steve, turning to the suburbs established after World War II, built almost entirely on once rural farmland, how did the rise of suburbs transform our rural spaces?
Yeah, I think when we talk about the so-called disappearance of the rural areas in certain parts of the country, what we have to recognize is that they simply became suburban developments. And I was struck that when people have talked about the suburbs, they really have ignored this dimension of it, which is to say that, all of these big developments get built and still get built on farmland, which means, therefore, that rural communities built around agriculture are displaced or disturbed or in other distorted one way or another. Often farmers sell up and they go someplace else. Often they get chased out. Part of what suburbanites bring is this mythical notion of the pastoral. And then when they discover that it's noisy and dirty and smelly, they go to court to try to close down the remaining farms that are in this area that they like to look at, but they didn't really want to live next to. And I found a couple of really funny court cases where new suburbanites actually take these farmers to court and shut them down. So I think that the rural dimension of suburban development is something we've really ignored. And what it did to rural and has done to rural communities is a really important story that I tried to tell.
I think it's also interesting how you say that, that there are these fights over sewers and schools and services, but it's also the similar fights that occur in urban areas, that these two areas are not that far apart. Can you talk a bit about that? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think what you need to recognize, or at least that I came to recognize, is that all of the economic forces that affect us all, affect rural people, perhaps in different ways, but they're not separate and apart from any of this. So when we think about a rural area that's maybe growing, this is going to put a strain on everything from the sewers to the schools. And then that makes difficult choices for people who live there. Do we raise our taxes? Because the high school is no longer big enough for all the kids who are now here. But taxes are, we don't like to raise taxes much of the time. Do we build a water treatment plant or do we continue simply using septic tanks and well water? Right. And so I think these fights happen in every community. The flavors of those fights might be a little different, but they're essentially the same.
You have such an interesting contrast in the rise of rural shopping, and you're looking at retail chains like Penny's and Woolworths in the early 20th century, and then the contrast with Dollar General in Walmart in recent decades. How important were these early dollar stores in the development of rural retail?
I think that was one of the really interesting things that I discovered. When we think about Main Street in some small town in Nebraska, and we think about a mom and pop shop there, in fact, that was really almost never true. What you had on Main Street was a Woolworths or a Penny's, which was a nationally built chain of retail operations almost exclusively before the Second World War in small towns and agricultural communities, so that rural shoppers were already connected to national markets of consumer goods through Penny's and Woolworths. The busiest day of the week for many of these stores was Saturday, when all the farm families came in to do their shopping, but they were buying things that were manufactured in Chicago or Philadelphia, or in many cases, London. You were getting the world's goods brought to you through these chains. In the post-Second World War period, the Woolworths on Main Street all closed, or almost all of them closed, and they've been replaced with the big box retailers like Walmart. And then I was really fascinated by Dollar General because there are, we all know Walmart. We know that story. There may be 3,500 Walmarts around the country. There are probably 18,000 Dollar Generals. And they, exist almost exclusively in rural communities. And I would argue that they are not doing the kind of service to those communities that, say, the old Woolworths used to. They don't sponsor the Little League team. They aren't a place where you go to have a lunch at the lunch counter and so on and so forth. It's sort of bottom of the barrel, cheap as possible kind of retail.
Mm. Toward the end of your book, you describe American cities as often greener than our country's rural areas. And I mean, I found that really eye-opening. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I think when we think about cities, we tend to think in a kind of old way about, you know, the big polluting factories. So it's, you know, the steel mills of Pittsburgh or whatever it happens to be. But now I think when we are so focused on, as we ought to be, on carbon and energy usage, cities are more efficient energy users than rural areas are. You have to drive less if you have to drive at all. The per capita energy usage in New York City is far lower than it is in any rural community in the country. So if we are going to get serious about addressing the climate crisis, we're going to have to recognize that higher density living is more efficient in terms of energy usage, carbon and other greenhouse gases.
Hmm. I know you liked, as a historian, to stay in your lane in the past, but how should we change the way we talk about rural America? How can we have more productive conversations about the future of rural America?
Well, I think one of the things I've really been struck by is that if we want to really think seriously about revitalizing certain parts of rural America, and again, as I said at the outset, lots of different kinds of rural, I think what we want to start to do is to reinvest in the small cities and even small towns, because I think those, and you know this in Wisconsin, I know this in Ohio, you drive through some of these small towns and they're struggling. But I think that in terms of building an economic base, in terms of building social connections and sense of community, reinvesting in what amounts to the urban areas of rural America is really critical. And I think the kind of low density, very dispersed living that some people have gotten accustomed to is something we ought to move away from.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate
thank
the conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Yes.
This was fabulous. Thank you so much.
Steve Kahn is a history professor at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and author of the new book called The Lies of the Land, Seeing Rural America for What It Is and Isn't. You can catch all of our programs online. Visit our program page to stream or download more programs from The Morning Show. Visit WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As drivers face rising premiums, we examine the causes of vehicle insurance rate increases in Wisconsin and nationwide. The cost of auto insurance is outpacing inflation, according to the Insurance Information Institute, and analysts forecast little relief this year. Join the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tyler Leberti is an associate professor of risk and insurance at the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. Tyler, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So this Market Watch analysis indicating the average full coverage premium in Wisconsin rose almost 40% from 2022 to 2023. Why are car insurance rates rising at such a clip?
Well, there's multiple factors behind it, so we can't just point to one cause. Inflation does have something to do with it. While, you know, inflation has somewhat cooled over the last year, insurance companies can only price every 6 months to a year. And so inflation somewhat has a delayed reaction on insurers.
Mm-hmm.
Severe weather. But I think probably the primary causes have been the cost of car repairs and replacements.
Cost of car repairs and replacements. Is that means that as the cost of cars go up, that it becomes pricier to fix or to total?
Yes. So obviously inflation has an impact on this as well. But the cars themselves have had a lot more technology in them, a lot of electric vehicles. Create some pricing issues for insurers. And as a result, it's just costlier to repair, find replacement parts. And there were low inventories, especially during COVID period. And so that led to increasing costs for insurers.
Have insurers figured out how to price the EV market with premiums, or is this kind of new ground still?
Yeah, so it is new ground. They don't have as much data on it. That's insurance companies like to have a lot of information and data, and just given the somewhat newness of electric vehicles, they don't have as much. But the insurers are getting somewhat, more comfortable pricing electric vehicles. It is more expensive to insure electric vehicle. In fact, Teslas continue to be the most expensive car models on the market to insure, because they sort of have higher upfront and repair costs than other vehicles.
So when you look state by state, there's a bank rate report showing Florida as the most expensive state to buy full coverage auto insurance at almost $4,000 a year. How does Wisconsin's insurance rates for cars compare to other states?
Well, while it might not feel like it, Wisconsin's actually one of the cheaper states. It's probably ranked the ninth lowest average auto insurance premium among the 50 states. And so the average cost of full coverage is projected to be in 2024 about $1,500, which is lower than the national average, about $2,000.
I felt that when I moved from Louisiana some years ago. There was a big difference in a positive way.
Yeah, so Louisiana is right behind Florida as being... The next highest, yeah.
But, I guess, how does your state or how does your zip code even affect what you pay?
Yeah, so there's that's a big rating factor of where you live, and mainly because it's where you drive. And so density of population, risk factors like auto thefts and likelihood of getting into an auto accident is going to be driven by location. And so zip code is a big factor determining the price.
Basically, like more claims in your area, even though you don't have a claim, that could actually affect that policy and what you pay.
Yes, if it's related to the actual location, in the sense if there's a lot of car thefts or car break-ins in a certain zip code, even though your car hasn't been impacted, the probability of your car being affected by this in the future is going to increase, and therefore insurance companies have to factor it into that prices.
We're looking at the factors about the recent rise in auto insurance premiums. Tyler Leverty with us, Associate Professor of Risk and Insurance at UW-Madison. You can call in with your questions. You can share your concerns at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tyler, the head of the Insurance Information Institute, told NPR that riskier driving behavior is contributing to rising auto insurance rates. Are motorists driving more dangerous today than in previous years?
So I think the biggest cause of that is that cell phone usage while driving is becoming the primary cause of sort of this distracted driving increase. And so that's leading to a rise in accidents, injuries, and fatalities. And I think that's what the III, the Insurance Information Institute report, is trying to profile when they talk about the increase in risky driving.
And meanwhile, last year, the Milwaukee Police Department noted a significant spike in reckless driving citations being issued. Does reckless driving affect auto insurance rates on a city-by-city basis?
Absolutely, yes. So that has been been an increase, an especially increase during the pandemic, because there were less cars on the road. And so this led to people feeling comfortable speeding and driving at higher rates of speed. And that led to, you know, higher severity accidents.
What is the effect of like a citation, or what is the effect of a speeding ticket on your rate and what the insurer is going to offer you in the premium?
Well, so the simple lineup is that it's going to increase your premium. So drivers with a traffic violation are going to see an average car insurance rate in about 50% in 2024. And if you get into an accident, probably even higher than that.
50% higher I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, yeah, 50% on average across the United States.
Across the United States, okay. What if, like, you're in an accident, it's not your fault? Could that affect your rate?
So the short answer is, unfortunately, yes, it could affect your rate because it speaks to where you're driving. And even though it's, you know, completely not your fault, you got into an accident, and it makes it more likely that you'll get into future accidents.
Could Wisconsin's insurance commissioner step in at any point to reduce costs to drivers? Is this something that the insurance office would be watching?
So first, I think they would be watching this, absolutely, especially as we've seen 2 years of price increases, substantial price increases. In auto insurance, 12% in 2024 is projected. And then last year, they increased on average about 11% across the country. Now, speaking to whether the insurance regulator can do something about that, I think that's tricky. When the regulator sort of intervenes, what they're going to do is sort of put a cap on prices. And that's problematic because that creates an availability problem, which will likely just increase prices in the future. And so a lot of research suggests that they probably shouldn't do that. Markets are more efficient when regulators don't intervene on pricing.
Let's bring in a call. Denny in Wapaka is here. Denny, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. My question to the guest is, I am a businessman. I own two businesses. But right now, most of the data I'm reading in The Economist, Wall Street Journal, and others are that the major price increases in our country, including inflation, are about half driven by flat gouging. And I am a businessman. My cost of products have gone up that I purchased to resell have gone up 45% in the last 24 months. How much of the insurance increase is just profit taking?
Thanks, Denny. Yeah, Tyler.
So there's two elements to that. First off, the insurance industry, especially with respect to auto insurance, have been paying out on average about $1.10 for every $1 they collect in premium. So insurance companies over the last 2 years have been losing money. So insurance companies are not gouging. However, they do need parts and repair costs to pay their claims. To the extent that there are price increases or price gouging in that domain, it does impact the auto insurance premium.
Tyler Leverty is an associate professor of risk and insurance at the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. As we discuss increases in the cost of car insurance, call in with a question. You can add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As car insurance policies continue to climb nationwide, we learn about why premiums are becoming more expensive, and we get the view from Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share your concerns at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tyler Leverty is an associate professor of risk and insurance at the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. Let's bring in a call. Laura in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I have a question regarding my partner and I, we're in a relationship, right? But he has his own house. I have my own house, own insurances. We both have our own car insurances. But my insurance company stated that he needed to be on my plan because he drives my car maybe once a month, if that. Is that true? Because if he's already covered under one insurance, why does he have to be on mine?
Laura, thank you. Tyler, what do you make of that scenario?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I agree with the caller. I don't think it's necessary that you keep separate residence, separate cars. The other driver does not need to be on your insurance. So I'm sort of puzzled why the insurance company would request that. It would change if you're married, but given that you're not and you have separate residence, separate cars, auto insurance follows the owner of the car. And so they own separate cars. I think it's fine.
Laura, thank you for that call. Robert now in Stevens Point. Robert, hi.
Yes, good morning. Say, I'd like to ask your guest, why will rates vary from one provider to another? What are some of those reasons?
Okay. So the reason why insurance companies have various rates is they have different target markets, different underwriting standards, different expenses. And as a result, you know, one insurer may be focused on sort of a more of a high risk driver because they have sufficient number of insureds that fit that demographic. And so that allows them to feel comfortable in pricing and pooling those risks. Whereas another insurer prefers to insure low risk drivers that have, you know, a clean driving record. And so it just depends on their target market and the statistics behind risk pooling that allows them to do what they do, which is effectively take risks from many, many, many different people. And because they collect it from a large group of people, they can predict losses within a pretty narrow range and essentially eliminate the risk.
So really these algorithms driving the policy and what is put forth by the insurer.
Yes. And I think that sort of that question brings up a relevant thing that a person can do to try to lower their insurance costs, and that is shop around, right? So if people find that their insurance rates have gone up significantly, one key way to save some money is to shop around because roughly about 70% of auto insurance owners, when they shopped around to find a better deal, they found it. And so that's a great way to try to reduce your auto insurance costs.
We see auto insurers like State Farm and Progressive and Allstate promising discounts if they can monitor your driving habits. Are programs like those worthwhile?
So it depends on the person. So if somebody's willing to have a telematics device in their vehicle and they feel that they're a great driver, then that's a great program to have because there are significant discounts. And there's also a lot of evidence suggesting that when people use those, it can change their behavior and make them better drivers because they learn some of their weaknesses. And so if somebody's willing to have that in their vehicle, they are going to get a price discount. On the flip side, if you're a terrible driver and you know it, you maybe not want to install one of these drivers because the insurance company is going to quickly learn about that.
Let's bring in Margaret in Madison now. Margaret, hi.
Good morning. My question for your guest is, does the cost of reinsurance affect the premium that folks are paying? For insurers that write multiple lines, we know that there are areas in the country where they're spending a lot of money on homeowners. Their reinsurance rates are going up. I'm wondering if that's affecting our cost of auto premium.
Well, that's an excellent question. You have a lot of insurance industry knowledge. Absolutely, the cost of reinsurance is going to find its way into the premium, your auto insurance premium, because most auto insurers are going to purchase reinsurance to protect them against their unforeseen losses. And so if that cost increases, that's going to lead to an increase for the policyholder. Now, you alluded to the fact that there's maybe some reinsurance price increases in, say, property lines, wildfire, like California, for example, or hurricanes in Florida. That probably won't find itself to large extent into auto insurance premiums,
okay.
But it would affect homeowners.
Margaret, thank you for that question. As we talk about the rise in auto insurance premiums, and we hear about it through Tyler Leberty, Associate Professor of Risk and Insurance at UW-Madison. Call in with questions. You can share comments at 800-642-1234. Examining natural disasters, the Minnesota Commissioner of Commerce says natural disasters are driving up insurance costs. How affected or exposed is Wisconsin compared to states that face more natural disasters like hurricanes or tornadoes?
Well, so convective storms, particularly like tornadoes and hailstorms, have a big impact on auto physical damage. Since these sort of events happen suddenly and affect hundreds or if not thousands of cars in one area, and so that cost of sort of the repair for body damage could be quite sizable. And so these types of events do indeed happen in Wisconsin and the Midwest, and those are probably the biggest cause of auto insurance losses. Obviously, there's hurricanes and floods that do not happen as much, the floods at least in the Wisconsin area, but hailstorms and tornadoes do indeed.
So with flooded cars, though, how does your policy generally approach floods when a car is submerged?
Yeah, so first, floods are covered in auto insurance.
Okay.
And different than for homeowners. Homeowners insurance companies do not cover floods. That's covered under the National Flood Insurance Program. But for automobiles and auto physical damage because of a flood, it will be covered by your auto insurer.
Are insurance companies changing how they assess whether a vehicle should be totaled from an accident?
Well, so if the cost of repair and replacement increases, and that goes that rises above the level which the total value of the car is, then that's going to be the influence. So the extent there, I don't think they're changing how they're doing this, but the repair and replacement costs, if those increase, it's going to increase the number of instances where they find that there's a total loss.
How can drivers know if their auto insurance coverage is adequate for the price they're paying?
So in the United States, we have a very low level of required insurance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just comparing that to other high, rich countries like Great Britain or Germany. In the United States, we have sort of what I refer to like a Spartan car insurance. It sort of stands out in the rich world. We have legal minimum bodily injury coverage that obviously varies state by state, but nowhere does that minimum actually pass $100,000 per accident. Whereas in Germany, drivers are required to have over $8.2 million in coverage.
Wow.
In Britain, it's limited. And so to answer your question is I think if you're buying minimum limits, that's probably not going to be sufficient to cover the costs of accidents today. So it depends critically on sort of, your comfort level of how much risk you're willing to bear outside of your insurance.
Well, Tyler, appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Tyler Leberty is an associate professor of risk and insurance at the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. Staying in this orbit, we're going to shift our attention to home insurance and what is going on in that marketplace. You can call in with a question. You can share your comments as we talk with a spokesperson for the Insurance Information Institute. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the rising cost of home insurance and what to expect in Wisconsin. California-based Farmers Insurance showed the biggest jump in home insurance premiums for 2023. That analysis by S&P Global Market Intelligence. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Scott Holman is a spokesperson for the Insurance Information Institute. Scott, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So this Policy Genius analysis shows Wisconsin homeowners insurance premiums grew 15% from May 2022 to May of last year. What is causing this increase?
Well, first I want to say Wisconsin tends to be among the lower priced states for home and auto insurance. So, but we are seeing this trend of both rates rising nationwide. And, you know, we've seen homeowners insurance premium rates rise significantly since the pandemic. And a lot of that can be attributed to supply chain issues and labor shortages. That's driving up the cost of home repairs and replacement. But there are some other long-term trends that also affect rates. And it's important for both consumers and policymakers to understand why this is happening and why it's probably going to continue. There are three key drivers for rate increases right now. We're seeing a rising number of catastrophic losses due to extreme weather events. Mm. We are also seeing people move into disaster-prone areas. More people are moving into harm's way. And then, again, we are seeing those increasing home repair and rebuilding costs.
So, stepping back here, why does Wisconsin trend lower in the cost of homeowners insurance and car insurance in Wisconsin? As you list those factors, why is Wisconsin trending lower?
Well, that could have to do with a variety of factors, including the claims experiences in that state, the number of people, the number of insurance companies doing business, all the way to how your insurance regulators are protecting the market in Wisconsin. There are a variety of factors that help determine where rates are going.
Your institute reports suggest homeowners insurance was unprofitable in 4 out of 5 years from 2017 to 2021. How much were these unprofitable? What is that factor like?
Well, there's something in insurance that determines how profitability is measured. You know, any business needs to make a reasonable profit. And insurers' underwriting profitability is measured by what's called the combined ratio. And that's a calculation that divides losses and expenses by earned premium. So a combined ratio under 100% indicates a profit for the company. A ratio above 100 indicates a loss. And in four of the last 5 years, it's been unprofitable. So think of it as if every dollar being paid to an insurance company is going out, that sets the combined ratio at 100. If more dollars are going out than coming in, that's going to be above 100, and that's where we're going to see those losses for companies. And, you know, insurance companies don't just rely on premiums. They take money that they have in reserves and they invest that, but they are required by law and their regulators to keep certain reserves on hand. And so they can't keep spending that down. And, you know, they need to keep the money that has been invested with them by policyholders, that in case there is an emergency, that money's there to pay out those claims and award that promise to pay.
But that must become very tricky, that reserve, that cushion, when you have populations moving into disaster-prone areas. What are those dynamics?
Well, you're right. And in the past year, we've seen losses for insurance companies pile up because of storms, natural disasters, inflation. So many companies are in the red, but it's not just places like that we hear of in the news a lot, like Florida, where there are hurricanes, and California, where there are wildfires. Last year, we saw states like Arkansas and Mississippi get hit by major tornadoes in the first half of the year. But the result is, from this activity, is since the start of last year, Regulators have approved double-digit rate increases in at least 31 states, according to analysis by S&P Global. Some of the states have had really big ones. Arizona, Texas, North Carolina, Oregon, Illinois, and Utah had some of the biggest approved increases, ranging from 20 to 30%. And we're seeing some companies halting sales of new policies. Insurance is a very competitive industry, but with some of the trends that are out there, insurance companies are going to have to take a look at how they're doing business and what they're selling. I know we're concentrating on homeowners here, but you saw in Wisconsin, I think it started in Wisconsin, the Kia Hyundai auto trend. When you see events that are really having an impact on the market, there's going to be a reaction to that.
Scott Holman, a spokesperson for the New York City-based Insurance Information Institute, as we discuss homeowners insurance. And you can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Eugene in Viola is here. Eugene, hi.
Good morning. I've got about a 10-room Victoria, and I've had it for a little better than 50 years. When it was built, it was wired for a 32-volt light plant. It still got knob and tube wiring and 60-amp service. And I had insurance at one time, but I can't find it now. I've never had any troubles with the wiring because I never overload the circuits very much. I can't find insurance.
So you can't find insurance for this old Victorian home that has, knob and tube wiring. Scott, have you heard issues like this before?
Well, I'm not sure how much shopping around you've done. You might want to consult an insurance broker who works on behalf of a consumer. It's brokers and agents are a little bit different. Agents sell directly and they work on behalf of companies. Brokers work on behalf of the consumers, and they shop around and try to find the kind of coverage you need. Have you tried the surplus lines market, or those are usually very specific kind of high risk situations?
Surplus lines market, what do you mean by that?
Surplus lines are if you're not getting if you can't get what you need in home and automobile companies, there are companies that specialize in what's called surplus lines, and so there are other kind of specialized insurance. But this caller, Eugene, might want to consult with an insurance broker to do some shopping around for him, or see if he can reach out to someone who sells surplus line products who may be able to offer some assistance.
Eugene, thank you for that call. Nate from Milwaukee called in. Nate's curious how insurance companies pool homes to make sure the risk is appropriate for the location. For instance, Nate says, do rates in Wisconsin go up alongside homes in Florida?
Well, insurance is all about spreading the risk, but it is related to the market you're in. So it should follow what the trends are where you live and in your market. So you shouldn't have to worry about subsidizing in Florida. And Florida is a completely different situation. They have if any of their insurance companies get in trouble, they have what's called it's a high risk pool that is like the insurer of last resort that people can get insurance from. But if that runs out of money, if there's a disaster and they run out of money, any person who has insurance, whether it's home or auto, get a special tax to help cover that. So but that's a different situation than I don't know of any other state where that happens, but that's a situation in Florida. But spreading the risk in your state and your insurance regulator at the Wisconsin Insurance Department, they are watching this, and if you're concerned about that, that is a great resource for you to ask questions or find out how they're regulating your local market.
Would an insurance company like refuse to renew a policy because or give you a policy because of a home's condition or its age?
Well, they certainly could. Mitigation is a crucial factor, and it's becoming more and more important to protecting our property. That, you know, containing or reducing premium rates, that requires gaining control over claims. And so preemptive measures to protect your property is very important. And you know, fortunately right now, the InsurTech space is providing a lot of solutions that can help. You can take steps to reduce weather-related damage by installing smart home technology that detects certain vulnerabilities like plumbing leaks before they result in a claim. And when you do some of this mitigation, whether it's getting a grade A roof if you're in a hurricane area, or if you're taking care of vegetation around your home if you're in a wildfire prone area, these mitigation steps, make sure that you're reporting those to your insurance professional and ask what discounts you may qualify for, but make sure that they know that you're doing this, because that could impact the amount of rates that you have. But you know, we're of the belief that we all need to be risk managers in today's world. There's a responsibility for everyone, whether it's communities, consumers, policymakers, and the insurance industry, to help improve how and where we're living. You know, the simple fact is more and more people are living in harm's way, and it's really essential for us to shift from detecting and repairing loss events to predicting and preventing damage and loss before it occurs. And so that's why it's important for us to look for some of those solutions to help through tech devices, and but also policymakers to maybe make some decisions about where we're building and where, you know, people are deciding to live.
Scott Holman is with the Insurance Information Institute as we discuss home insurance policies and the view in Wisconsin. You can call in with a question. Share your insights at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the factors in home insurance policy rates rising by double digits in 2023 and strategies for how to shop for a policy here in Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share your comments along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Scott Holman is with the Insurance Information Institute. So, Scott, the Institute says labor and material costs are factors affecting homeowners' insurance premiums. What materials are becoming more expensive in recent years?
Well, if you make a trip to the hardware store, almost everything you purchase there, you're going to see, whether it's wood or roofing materials. So just about everything has gone up since the pandemic.
Everything is going up, and that means that those costs go right into, to those policies.
Correct.
And the Institute expecting premium rates will need to increase in the years ahead. How long should homeowners expect rates to go up?
Well, until we can get a reversal on some of these trends, I think that we should expect to see some increases. There is something that is important that I think that the consumer should talk about with their insurance professional. And that's, we recommend that every year you have a conversation with your insurance professional to talk about what's changed in your situation. Do you have kids that are no longer living at home? Have you made an improvement to your kitchen? Make sure you have those conversations so that you have that right amount of coverage. You don't want to have too much. You don't want to have too little. And you don't want any surprises that if you have to file a claim that, you know, for some reason you're not getting what you expected. There are different kinds of coverage that you get when purchasing homeowner insurance. One, there's actual cash value, and that policy pays to replace the home or possessions minus a deductible for depreciation. So if building costs are high, that's probably not the kind of policy you want. It'll give you what your home at the time is worth minus depreciation. There's replacement cost coverage, which replaces without a deduction, but then there's also something called guaranteed or extended replacement costs, and that policy offers the highest level of protection. And a guaranteed replacement cost policy pays whatever it costs to rebuild the home as it was before, say, a fire or whatever disaster, even if it exceeds the policy limit.
And along those lines, as you explain replacement cost and actual cash value, there was a report from UW Extension showing median home sale prices jumped more than 150% from 2012 to 2023. How can Wisconsin homeowners find out if they're underinsured?
Well, you want to make sure that you trust the valuation that's placed on your home, and you want to make sure that if you're seeing those values change, you want to make sure that you're talking to your insurance professional to make sure that that person understands what the market is, and then and go over what you would need if something happens. You don't want any surprises, and that's why you want to make sure that if there are changes that you make or enhancements that you make, you want to report that. But you also want to ask, if you're doing some of these things, can that get me a bit of a discount? One thing we should also point out for people is we recommend that everyone have what's called a home inventory. This is a document, and most companies that sell insurance have apps that are available for your smartphone. If you've got teenage kids who like to play with the phone, give it to them. Take video, take pictures, go from room to room, open drawers and doors, take an inventory of what you own. And for those high-priced items and electronics, if you can, save copies of receipts or click pictures of serial numbers. Keep this record and go room by room and keep that record and make sure that you store that in the cloud or someplace safe so that if you have a fire or something happens, if you have to file a claim, that's going to make that process so much easier, and it's going to give you a peace of mind. You may think you know what you own, but if you were suddenly to lose everything, close your eyes and go from room to room, can you remember everything that's there? Probably not. Women who have expensive purses and shoes, make sure that you're documenting items like that. Go really through everything that you have, and then talk about your coverage needs and your level of potential risk with your insurance professional to find out what you need. You know, one thing that a lot of people don't have is flood insurance. And, you know, when you're shopping for a home, a lot of times realtors will tell you, well, you're not in a floodplain, you don't need to worry about that. We like to say, if it rains where you live, you need to consider flood insurance. And that's sold through the National Flood Insurance Program. And more private insurers are starting to sell it. But, if you have a basement and it floods as a result of rain, that's not covered by a standard homeowner's policy. So we're hopeful that more and more people will really understand the kind of risk they're exposed to. And especially as we're seeing, climate changes impact the kind of weather we're seeing.
Scott Holman is with the Insurance Information Institute as we discuss homeowners insurance. You can call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Anne is here in Mequon. Anne, hi.
Hi, thank you so much. I have a question about replacement contents in a home. If you have a fire and the house burns down, and you have $300,000 worth of coverage. I had a friend in Colorado whose house burned down in the mountains, and she had to replace her content basically with in-kind. So in other words, if you had 50 shirts, you had to replace them with 50 shirts. If you only replaced 40 of the shirts, you didn't get that money that you've been paying insurance, for. So she said, she felt like she didn't understand her policy and what that replacement contents is. So my question is, if you have, let's say, $200,000 in replacement contents, would you just be given a check if you had a total disaster, or would you have to document every purchase you made with the insurance company?
Anne, thank you for that. Scott.
Well, that's why it's really important to have some conversations before you buy a policy to make sure that you understand what's going to happen if you need to file a claim. As I mentioned just a few minutes ago, there are different kinds of policies that you can purchase. You will be having to show, what you've lost. And that's going to vary from what kind of documents you have to what, if it's a fire, there's going to be probably some reports with your fire department and things that are available, but go over with your insurance professional about what kind of replacement that your policy covers. I said earlier that insurance is a very competitive industry and there are a lot of people competing for your business, and you probably can't watch a TV show or a football game without getting those messages.
Without seeing Dr. Rick from Progressive.
So
specifically.
But because it is so competitive, they're different. They write their policies differently. So that's why it's important to ask questions and to find out what you have, because you don't want to be surprised if you have a fire and lose something that it's not being settled in the manner of which you expected. We encourage people to shop around annually to make sure that you're getting the good rate, but also talk to your friends and family who have insurance and find out what their experiences are. Talk to people who've had to file a claim and say, what did you learn? What did you not know? What would you recommend?
Gather that information. Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Scott Holman is a spokesperson for the Insurance Information Institute. If you visit our program page, you can stream or download more programs from the morning show. If you missed part of our conversation, you can stream a recording later on at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network.